Let's move on to agenda item 14. That's the Dynegy Moss Landing Power Plant permit. Mr. Briggs?
Thank you, Roger Briggs. This item is for renewal of the waste discharge requirements for the surface impoundments for the cleaning waste from the power plant pursuant to the Toxic Pit Cleanup Act, and this is for the Moss Landing Power Plant, Dynegy's Moss Landing Power Plant. And David Schwartz, part of our staff, will be giving the presentation. And a reminder that we did send out David's presentation as well as Dynegy's presentation, so you should all have that available, either hard copy or otherwise. And another reminder that we sent out a supplemental sheet last week on Friday, which pretty much boils down to Coast Keeper's comments and our response. So,
excuse me, Mr. Briggs, can you tell us what all the supplemental sheets? I have three here in Moss Landing. One is the supplemental staff summary, the Dynegy presentation, and the staff presentation. Are those the only three documents?
You should have a postkeeper letter from the
Well, that's included.
It's part of the supplemental sheet, which should be in yellow paper.
This is Sheila Sofer with the water board. Actually, the supplemental sheet itself has three attachments, and one of those is Monterey Coast Keeper's letter, the Swimming Miscellaneous newspaper public notice, as well as the water board notice of public hearing.
We all swear.
Mr. Jeffries, do you have everything identified?
Yes, I have everything identified. I just want to say, Mr. Chair, when other than Mr. Briggs is speaking in San Luis Obispo, we're having a hard time hearing.
Okay. Are you having a hard time hearing myself?
No.
Okay.
Or Mr. Hodgkin, we can hear him fine. I can hear Mr. Briggs, but when any of the board members or the staff is talking, it's very difficult.
Let's have David Schwartzbart try. If you could speak right into the mic, and if you can't hear him, let us interrupt and let us know, and we can move him over here to the telephone.
Okay, we can hear you fine, Roger.
Okay.
This is David Schwartzbart, Water Board Staff Geologist. I'll try to yell. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
We can hear you. And David, as you proceed, why don't you let us know which page you're on in your presentation, because then we can visually keep track of what you're putting up on the overhead.
All right. I'm now on page 2, the second slide.
Ah, okay.
We are discussing today the renewal of waste discharge requirements for three hazardous waste ponds at the Moss Landing Power Plant. The power plant, and I'm on slide 2, is owned by Dynegy Moss Landing, LLC. It's in Moss Landing of Monterey County at the intersection of Highway 1 and Dolan Road. It is a fossil fuel fired power plant now burning natural gas. The plant has been operating since the late 60s. It is on a fairly sensitive piece of land surrounded on three sides by surface water and with shallow underlying groundwater. The ponds that we're talking about have been operating and permitted in their current configuration since about the late 80s. This resolution focuses on exemptions from the Toxic Pit Cleanup Act for the three impoundments. Slide 3. The three hazardous waste impoundments, the topic today, are shown in the photo. They are fairly small. Look at the truck in the lower right of the photo for scale. During periodic cleaning at the power plant, wastewater is generated that qualifies as hazardous waste because of elevated metals concentrations and low or high pH. That wastewater is discharged into these ponds for temporary storage and treatment by pH adjustment and precipitation. The clean wastewater or the supernatant is then pumped to the plant-wide cooling water system and eventually discharged the surface water pursuant to the plant's Clean Water Act permit. The sludge is run through the filter press to dry it and then trucked off-site to the Kettleman Hills Waste Disposal Facility. Slide 4. The ponds are built with containment systems to prevent environmental release. One of the most important of these is the triple bottom liner. Each one of these three systems is comprised of a high-density polyethylene plastic liner underlain by a liquid collection removal system. This photograph in slide 4 shows the outlet of these three liquid collection systems at one of the ponds. The upper two liquid collection systems are considered leachate collection systems because they're intended to remove wastewater that might be released from the pond. The bottom, though, is considered a groundwater collection system. It's intended to remove potentially rising groundwater. Slide 5. And I apologize for the poor quality of this map. The ponds are monitored for potential release in several ways. One thing that's done is to monitor groundwater underneath the ponds. The ponds are shown here and down here. The groundwater monitoring wells are shown as blue dots. Groundwater monitoring is done quarterly. It's been done since the late 80s or so, actually mid-80s, when the ponds were first permitted. The underlying liquid collection removal systems are also monitored to make sure they're functioning properly. The bottom liners themselves are monitored for structural integrity. And these monitoring systems in conjunction indicate a release or lack of release. Slide 6. That's a little bit about the physical status of the pond. And now on to the law. The ponds are permitted by two different laws. One is the first, the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, in conjunction with California Title 22 laws, form the primary hazardous waste laws of this state. Those laws are administered by the Department of Toxic Substance Control. That department has issued a hazardous waste permit for these ponds, did issue it first in 1988 and has updated it as needed. It is quite complete. That hazardous waste permit is quite complete and detailed, and the DCSC people put a lot of energy into regulating these ponds. We, the Water Board, also regulate the ponds pursuant to Title 23 of the California Code of Regulations, and our Title 23 waste discharge requirements are more or less redundant, except for a redundant with a hazardous waste permit, except for the fact that they grant exemptions from the Toxic Pit Cleanup Act of 1984. That act basically prohibited these subject ponds from operating unless they were retrofitted with double bottom liners and they were exempted by the Water Board. For the Water Board to exempt them, they must make certain findings. And these exemptions are only good for 5 years. So the Board must renew these exemptions every 5 years, as they have done. The current exemptions expire October 22, 2009, and that is why we are here today. Slide 7. Water Board must make certain findings to renew these TIFCA exemptions, exemptions from the Toxic Pit Cleanup Act of 1984. And I have here the findings that the Board must make. They're very loosely paraphrased. The Board must find that the ponds have not polluted, are not likely to pollute, that the waste streams do not include extremely hazardous waste, that the ponds are only for temporary storage and discontinuous batch treatment, the restricted hazardous waste is removed from the ponds within 30 days, that the ponds are inspected prior to each use, that the ponds are tested annually for integrity, that the ponds are double-lined and have liquid collection systems, that groundwater is monitored, and that a hydrogeologic assessment report was prepared, submitted, and approved. All of these findings are satisfied this time, just as they have been every 5 years in the past. During the public participation, we did receive comments from one party, Monterey Coastkeeper. This slide 8 refers to the first comment of Monterey Coastkeeper. They essentially commented that the public notice process that was followed for this proceeding was deficient. Our water board staff supplemental sheet responds that essentially the public notice was adequate. I'd like to note that there were two public notices at least that were given. One was given June 17 of this year, and it notified of the September 11 hearing. When that hearing date was changed, another public notice was issued July 31, 2009, which referred to today's hearing. So there has been a total of about 2.5 months of public notice since the June 17 notice until today. Therefore, slide 10 has staff recommendations for the board. Those are essentially to make the findings, to renew the TIF. Wait a minute, we skipped this slide. We are on slide 9, I'm sorry. Slide 9 refers to the second comment of the Monterey Coastkeeper. They essentially commented that the groundwater monitoring data could indicate a release, might indicate an actual release from the pond. Water Board staff responded again in the supplemental sheet that although some of the groundwater monitoring parameters have shown statistical increases, when those data are considered in conjunction with other data, such as the lack of wastewater in the liquid collection system and the integrity of the pond and other direct physical data, no release has been indicated. And now we're on to slide 10 of staff recommendations to the board. Three recommendations. The board should make the findings, or is recommended to make the findings that are necessary to renew the TIFCA exemptions. The board should renew the TIFCA exemptions for 5 years, and the board is recommended to adopt Waste Discharge Requirement Order R3-2009-49. I'll be glad to entertain questions.
Any board questions on staff's presentation?
Tom O'Malley, I do have one question for
you. Go ahead, Mr. O'Malley.
Chair, we can't hear him.
Mr. O'Malley, could you get close to the telephone speakerphone?
Can you hear me now?
A little better.
Well, this is just a for-the-record question for our attorney. It is a little confusing because we have had some changes in meetings and format and notice, and I just wanted to confirm with our attorney that we have complied with the public notification. We're in compliance with that.
Yeah, this is Frances McChesney, and yes, the public notice requirements have been satisfied. There are several different ones that apply, but they basically required at the beginning 45 days notice of the meeting, which was satisfied by the June 17th public notice, and the board actually provided additional notice that technically did not have to require when the board meeting was changed to August 31st. It was only necessary to notice that the meeting had changed and not really allow for additional public comment, but the staff allowed for additional public comment on July 31st for an additional 30 days. So actually more than the necessary minimum public notice has been provided.
Okay, thank you.
Any other board comments or questions on this item? Not on this item, but on staff's presentation.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't have any questions on the presentation, but I would ask, in San Luis Obispo, we're having a hard time hearing the speakers from there, and especially when they're doing their presentation, evidently they're moving their head from side to side, so they fade in and out as they're doing their presentation. So I'm requesting they speak directly into the microphone so we can hear them.
Okay, Mr. Briggs?
Could you hear David Schwartzbart okay?
Well, evidently during his presentation he was moving his head, and part of it would fade in and out on us.
Okay, well, we might try having subsequent presentations up here at my location since you can hear me okay.
If you have any other presentation, I would suggest you do so.
Okay.
Are we going to have Dinah's presentation?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, if there's no further board comments or questions at this point in time, why don't we move to Dinah's presentation?
Okay. Okay. Speaking for Dynegy, there are three gentlemen here for Dynegy, but the two other gentlemen are here for questions. And speaking for Dynegy will be Lee Genn, Senior Environmental Compliance Specialist. And Lee, you can come up here. Seems to be the best spot.
And Mr. Briggs, how do you spell his last name?
G-E-N-Z.
Okay.
Try it again, please, louder.
Lee Genz, his name is L-E-E-G-E-N-Z.
And Mr. Briggs, are you, I take it, watching the clock, and do we have a time limit on any presentations?
3 minutes, right? Yeah, 3 minutes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Will you watch the clock?
I got it.
Thank you.
Good morning, members of the board, Mr. Briggs. Can everyone hear me okay?
And yes, I can hear you. This is the chair in Santa Barbara. You're fine.
West Landing?
Well, it could be louder.
Okay. My name is Lee Genn, Senior Environmental Compliance Specialist at Dynegy Moss Landing, also known as Moss Landing Power Plant. The service impoundment five-year permit that we request you approve today is a very important part of the operation of our power generation. This permit with a TIPCA exemption is a privilege that we take very seriously. We demonstrate this through our annual employee training on all aspects of the impoundments, our daily inspections, our maintenance and upkeep of the impoundments and all piping and equipment, the yearly inspections of the liner by a California certified engineer, and our groundwater monitoring program. At this point, I'd like to refer to the 7-slide presentation that was sent to you last Friday. And with this, I'd like to expand a little bit on Mr. Schwartzbach's presentation, showing more detail of the triple liner system.
And excuse me, Mr. Genz, this is Jeff Young, the chair. As you proceed through your slides, if you would do the same as staff did, let us know which page you're on.
Will do.
Thank you.
Okay, slide number one. This, again, is just a larger photo showing the where the ponds are located at. We'll go to slide two, since that was from David. This one here, slide number two, is showing the ponds number one and two. You can see the depth. There are two different cells that are involved in here. They're 500,000 gallons each. They're sloped towards the far end. You can see a little bulge there in the end of the sloped area. That's where the leachate system is located. So if there's any releases at all, it will flow towards that system. To go to slide number three, this is basically showing how the system is set up. There's three liner systems with an 80 mil HDPE, and then there's a permeable geotextile layer and a geonet layer that's in between, and then that 4-inch pipe diameter that it flows to. I'm going to skip over to the next slide here, which is slide number four. This shows the HDPE liner material, and there you can see the geotextile and the geonet layers that are in between each of the liners. This allows any material, wastewater that is could go through the liner will flow down to the leachate system. Slide number five, this shows the piping again that, whoops, I think I went one more slide there. Okay, we're missing a slide. Yeah, there's one slide missing. So we'll go to slide number six. This shows the detection probes, and there's a pump also down at the bottom here. So this is at each of the, look, in the 4-inch collection pipes down in the leachate system. So when this is detected, it is pumped out by the pump on the bottom of that. Slide number seven is, this shows the total system for pond number one. So you have the leachate systems there, the piping and the tubing. There's a detection indicator box that the operators look at. And then there's a pneumatic pump control. And you see the tank there. When we do have anything in it, will be pumped into that tank so we can measure the volume that is collected.
Mr. Gens, a question for you. This is Jeff Young, Chair. Have you ever detected any leachate through this system?
Yes, we have. We have had some leaks in the primary liner, but it's never been past the secondary or tertiary liners. And when we do have a leak in those liners, we have in the monitoring reporting section of the permit, on the back page, there is a table, and it's a guideline for how we go about removing any of the material that would be in the pond. We would isolate the pond, and we would move everything into another pond, and then we would look for the leak. And generally what we do, we would fill that pond with salt water, seawater, and then that's a good indicator. And as we're filling it up, we would note when the leak starts. And we also bring in companies that have spark equipment that can actually find the leak.
And what usually causes a leak in this heavy, you know, plastic-type material? Is it wear and tear? Is it an interaction with the chemicals in the waste?
Most of the leaks that we've had have been pinhole-type leaks that are generally with the seams. When they put this material together, they have to weld it together with plastic. When they do that, they run a piece of copper into each one of the seams there, and then they use a spark detection meter to actually find those. So we have to bring in a contractor that would go over the whole surface impoundment to find these. But they can actually find tiny pinhole leaks with these methods. And again, I stress that we have never had anything go past the secondary or the tertiary liners.
Okay. Yes.
Russ Jeffries in Moss Landing. I have two questions. One, you pointed out the detector indicator light box. Is there an alarm that goes off in a single location, or is this the only detection location at the plant?
No, the detector box also is run to our control room. And so the control room, they would get an indication when this happens, and then they would send an operator out to look at this. Also, this system is inspected twice a day. We have two 12-hour shifts for our operation department. So they look at this system two times a day, and they log any information on that. So
that's fine. My second question is, have the liners ever been replaced since installed?
No, they have not.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead, Mr.
Okay. Again, there has never been a release from any of the three surface impoundments through all three liners, as I mentioned before. Again, daily monitoring of leachate collection, detection, removal system by operations department and the annual inspection of the impoundment liners confirm the integrity. Again, we ask you to please consider approving this five-year permit today. As we have shown, there's been no releases. And we continue to maintain a high-level program of operating and maintaining the three impoundments, and we'll continue to do so. We will also continue to comply with the California Health and Safety Codes for TIPCO requirements. Also, if you have any questions regarding our groundwater monitoring program, Mr. J.C. Isham, a certified hydrogeologist from Shaw Environmental, is here. Mr. Isham has been working for us and with DTSC on the groundwater monitoring program for over 20 years. And he was instrumental in developing the present statistical methods to analyze groundwater monitoring for release. So with that, if you have any questions for myself or Mr. Isham, I'd be glad to take those.
Mr. Chair, this is Russ Jeffries again. My last question for this gentleman, has there been any soil samples taken from underneath these ponds since they've been installed?
No, there have not. Primarily because we did not want to have any problem with the integrity of the liners, because the only way we could really do that was go directly through the pond and the concrete that's on the bottom of it. So there has not been any samples taken.
Thank you.
Any other board questions?
Yes, Mr. O'Malley has a question here.
Go ahead, Mr. O'Malley.
Thank you, and this is for the...
Can't hear Mr. O'Malley.
Hey, Mr. Tom O'Malley, a question or two for the last speaker. You mentioned that the pond liners have never been replaced. Do you have an estimate of the useful life on those pond liners?
Yes, we have a registered engineer that comes every year to inspect these ponds, and he's on a working group that actually is observing other HDPE liners throughout the United States. And by his inspections and looking at the integrity, he's keeping us updated as to whether we need to replace these or not.
I was wondering what the industry standard was, and if in other locations, what the experience has been for when these liners need to be replaced. Is it a 20-year process or what?
At this time, they're looking at 15 to 20 years, and it depends on the use of the liners and the type of chemicals that actually enter the pond. Ours are more intermittent uses, so it's not a real daily type of use. So it's it just depends on the use and the chemicals.
Okay. And so if it's a 15 to 20-year potential life cycle, how many years have these pond liners been in use?
Yes.
Let's try up here. Speak real loudly.
We're going to have J.C. Isham discuss this.
My name is J.C. Isham, and I've got a considerable experience with HDPE liners and final covers and plastics. The industry standard for these type of HDPE liners, one of the protections is a black color, which is a lot of carbon black, and then there's various different types of plasticizers that are added to the liners. And one of the important aspects of the HDPE is its lack of reactivity with any chemicals, and that's noted by the fact that they have to be actually heat welded together. There are no natural solvents that can be used to soften the plastic, so there's no glues that can be used to add in its seaming. And the industry standard for HDPE generally is several hundred years. Unless it's exposed to sunlight, which is the aspect at this site, and then at that point, the useful use of the plasticizers within the plastics are between 50 and 100 years. This insulation has been there for about 20 years.
Since 1989.
The useful life, based on the use here, will probably be 50 years. So it's halfway through its useful cycle, and as Mr. Gens has said, it gets physically tested and reviewed by a registered civil engineer on an annual basis. These tests are looking for checking and cracking the effectiveness of the original seams. All these tests have indicated that the useful life, which is in its body, it's halftime, would indicate that there's several decades of useful use of the surface, the first liner. So the physical integrity of these plastics are well within commonly industry standards, and there's no indication that the plastic is close to its the end of its useful life.
Thank you.
I have a question for that speaker. This is Jeff Young in Santa Barbara. The pinhole leaks that have arisen so far, are those expected type leaks, or is that something that has been unexpected?
I'm going to ask Mr. Gens to answer that. It was the pinhole leak, I believe, was only discovered once. And after that pinhole leak were discovered, there's been no other indications of lack of integrity with the seam.
Mr. Chair, we're still having trouble hearing Sadler Savispo.
Could that answer be repeated for Mr. Jeffries and the folks at Moss Landing?
I believe there's only been one indication of a pinhole leak, and it's not a common occurrence, and it's not an occurrence that's been ongoing.
This is Lee Genskin. The pinhole leak that we had before, it happened at a weld seam, and so you have to understand there's a lot of weld seams there that they do test, and it was just, a small leak on that regard.
Okay.
The pinhole leak was not an indication of a degradation of the plastic or the other seams.
Mr. Chair, I can't hear that last speaker. I can hear Mr. Gantz very well.
Do we have that speaker come and speak as closely as Mr. Genz was speaking?
The indication of that one pinhole leak was not an indication. It only occurred once in a lifetime of the facility, and that indication was not an indication. That leak was not an indication of the lack of integrity of the plastics or the other seams at the site.
Did you hear that, Mr. Jeff?
Yes, but it's still difficult. The other speaker we can hear fine, but that last speaker, it's difficult to hear.
Okay. All right. Do we have any other or any further board questions for Mr. Genz and his staff?
Yeah, I have one. This is Gary Shellcross at Moss Landing.
Go ahead, Gary.
I don't know how this is going to work because my question is about slide 5, which apparently is missing from their overhead presentation, but it's in the packet that we got. Is it appropriate to ask a question about that?
This is Francis. Is that the slide that shows the three pipes?
Yeah.
Yeah, that slide was also in David's presentation, so I think it's available to everybody.
Okay. So my question is, there's this fence in front, sort of, that the pipes go through on the lower left-hand side, and my first question is, what's that fence for?
I don't understand the question. What are you referring to?
Looking at slide 5, it's an orange fence in the color, if you have a color slide.
Oh, yeah. The orange fence is to keep any animals from going into the impoundments.
Okay, so I'm just wondering why it's down on the right-hand side. It looks sort of in a state of disrepair.
Well, actually, that's the top of the actual bar in there. There's actually about 3.5 feet below that.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay, I was just curious. Morbid curiosity.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Most of the, we've had a skunk get into the pond one time, and so that's what is to keep the, during the drought period, sometimes animals are seeking water. So we keep this barrier around the surface impoundments. Just it's basically 1 and 2. Pond 3, it's not an issue. But I think the disrepair is on the top because of the pipe that's involved there.
Okay. I actually slide 7 sort of answers my question. Those that we're actually on slide 5 looking down at a slant.
That's correct.
Yeah. So it. Okay. I resolve my question. Thank you.
And this is Jeff Young. Question I have is looking at that slide 5. That's obviously a drained pond. And would that whole part of the slide that we're looking at be under wastewater when it's in use?
No. We have to keep at all times a 2-foot freeboard, and so the pipes we are seeing there is part of that 2-foot freeboard. There's been very few times we've ever come up to that 2-foot freeboard in the pond, but there's part of our procedure. Any waste that goes into the impoundments We have operators to observe. We have alarms. We have systems for the two-foot freeboard. Also, if you were to look back on slide number two, you would see the center wall there between the two cells. That is basically the two-foot freeboard when it gets up to that center wall. And if you look across in that center wall over to where the pipes are coming out, you'll see that that two-foot freeboard is well below where those pipes are. Do you see that?
I do, and actually now it's much clearer to me that slide five is really not a shot that's horizontal, but it is kind of vertical on an angle.
That's correct. The pond sides themselves are on a 45-degree angle.
Right. No, now I got it. Okay. All right. Any other board comments or questions of Mr. Gens or his staff? Okay. Do we have any speaker cards for this item? Is Mr. Shimek around?
Yes, we do have for Mr. Shimek here in Moss Landing.
Okay. Why don't we have Mr. Shimek address the board, Mr. Jeffries?
Okay. First of all, can I check before my time starts that everyone can hear me?
I can hear you, and John Hayashi can hear you very well in Santa Barbara.
Okay, thank you.
No problem in Scotts Valley.
Okay, thanks. All right. So I will be referring to my comment letter and the graphs in my comment letter. First of all, this is Steve Shimek, Monterey Coast Keeper in Monterey. I have two basic issues with this permit. One is the noticing, which is a technical issue. It's not the fault of staff, but it was brought about by the furloughs. That is no one's fault. But Dynegy did notice this, and with notice that said that the meeting would be in September, and people were able to comment in September. The Regional Water Quality Control Board, their notice says that comments will be taken until noon today. Well, so you're taking action on this before your comment period closes. Now, maybe formally, but from when the clock started, there's been, right? But you basically said that people could comment till noon today. Finally, the notice does not appear on your website in the public notices section or on the state website in the public notices section. So that's my first comment. The noticing was, if not improper, was very confusing. Second point is that there are spikes in the monitoring data. The staff report did not provide you with the monitoring data. I asked for the monitoring data, and staff was kind enough to provide it. You'll see that in the first graph, you'll see significant spikes in pH and from a number of the wells happening pretty much simultaneously. And my point would be that the way that these ponds work, as I understand it, is to regulate pH. On graph four, you'll notice that there are spikes in ammonia, very significant spikes in ammonia. And then in graphs 2 and 3, you just look at and see that the data is very variable. Arguments that these are well regulated, I don't know. I guess I would question how many people really look at the data. I just don't know how well regulated these types of ponds are. We did hear testimony that the useful life is 15, 20 years, and another person said, no, it's more like hundreds. But we are seeing pinhole leaks, and just because a plastic bag that you get at the market has a life of hundreds of years certainly does not mean that that plastic bag has a useful life of hundreds of years. I am asking for what I thought was a compromise. I was trying to suggest that what you do is you essentially give them a one-year permit so that people would have the chance to look at the data so that we could, now there's this useful life question,
and so that the public noticing could be less confusing. There is confusion about this item. I have received calls from both Ocean Conservancy and Surf Rider Foundation, so I would suggest that there is confusion. I would hope that you would end the confusion and recognize and end the confusion and suggest that the permit, instead of being given for 5 years, be given for one. Thank you.
Okay. Any board questions for Mr. Shimek?
Well, not for Mr. Shimek, but the graphs that he's referring to, I'd like to ask Dynalgy, especially on the one for monitoring for ammonia, which the data was from 2008 to 2009. It looks like there were some very high spikes in those particular monitoring periods. Can they respond to that?
Yes.
Yes, sir. My name is J.C. Isham, and I reviewed it.
Need to speak up.
Thank you.
My name is J.C. Isham, and I'm the geology manager for Shaw Environmental. I'm a
not working.
And I review this data.
Excuse me. This is the chair. We're having difficulty hearing you as clearly as we heard Mr. Ginn. So if you could please do whatever Mr. Gens did to make himself understandable, I would appreciate it.
Thank you. My name is J.C. Isham. I'm a certified hydrogeologist, and I review this data very closely with Lee Gens on a quarterly basis. The ammonia spike that we noticed just recently was a result of a laboratory error, and as in addition to the samples that we collected from the specific wells, we also collect various lab blanks and field blanks to determine if there are inequities within the data itself. So we determined that the latest spike, which appeared in all the wells, was actually due to a laboratory error in the ability for that lab to analyze ammonia at that time. All of the other laboratory data, at the same time, we also look at how other constituents that would also be signatures of a release. We saw no other constituents spike at that time. In addition to monitoring for just ammonia, we monitor for a whole suite of elements, and the indication of a leak is also correspond with the actual fluid measurements between the liners itself. So unless we see a fluid release, an indication of fluid between the liners, we have no physical evidence of water leaving the impoundment and working its way into the environment. And like I said, because we analyze for a suite of constituents, we also look for correlations between not just one chemical of concern, but several chemicals of concern. Last year, Lee Gens and myself had a very extensive meeting with hydrogeologists from the Department of Toxic Substances Control, in which we go over in fairly close detail all the monitoring data over a several-year period, and we scrutinize spikes like this. We try to correlate indications of release in not just one constituent but several constituents. We also look at correlations of release in not just one well but several wells. If you look at the groundwater contour map or the groundwater facility map that shows the location of wells, the wells are very closely spaced at this facility. This is a very small impoundment. It has a number of wells, both upgrading and downgrading. We correlate the data from the suite of constituents with upgrading wells and downgrading wells. We also correlate the velocity of groundwater movement beneath the impoundment. So we look for signatures of release. And since these ponds have been in existence from the late 80s, we have seen no signatures of release of any constituent over the entire facility. And the data is fairly variable. The site is very close to several surface water bodies. It's also very close to the Pacific Ocean. It's within a zone of saltwater intrusion. There's tidal influences that affect the groundwater quality. We look very closely at variabilities in the background wells. It's a it
it is a complicated hydrogeologic regime. Because of this, Lee Genza and myself, like I said, we review this very closely with water board staff and with staff of the Department of Toxic Substances Control. It's a highly regulated and closely watched groundwater monitoring program.
Question for you. This is Jeff Young. Looking at Figure 2A, at least, that's in Mr. Schimmick's letter. That's the ammonia parameter trend graph. You are looking at whether your liners are failing or not when you look at this data. You're trying to correlate that with releases. Do you look at potential sources for some of this variability apart from the release potential releases?
Yes, we do. And part of that signature of a release is not just the indication of any single chemical, but a signature of multiple chemicals because of the nature of the fluids within the impoundment. One of the important indicators of release, because the impoundment fluids have either very high or low pH values, is the indication of spikes in pH with other chemicals. Ammonia is just one chemical. Sulfate is also a very important other chemical. Iron is a very important chemical. You can see the iron staining on the plastic, which indicates there's high concentrations of iron. Iron is a very good indicator of release from this facility, so are spikes in pH. We look for spikes in more than one signature chemical.
Okay. I see that Mr. Schimmick didn't include a graph for iron in his letter. Has there been any spikes in iron?
No signature spikes that are correlatable with indications of fluids between the plastics, nor with indications of spikes with other signature chemicals. And it's this combination of review, and not just one well, but multiple wells, and not just the detection wells, but also the indications of changes in water quality in the background well. It's a complicated review, but I look at it very closely, and it's not just myself that looks at this data. It's the staff of the water board and staff of DTSC, and we have conference meetings to review this. It is a bit variable, and it is a bit complicated, and that's why we look at it so very closely. And it's not just myself, it's other registered professionals.
Mr. Chair, this is Russ Jeffries in Moss Landing. To follow up some on that question, referring back to the 2A on ammonia spiking, and Dynalogy is attributing the spiking to miscalculations from the lab that they had it sent to. Has the staff verified with Dynalogy, has it been retested, and has the staff verified that these spikes were errors of the lab that tested it?
This is Lee again. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Another thing with the ammonia is it depends on the constituents that are entering the pond. Ammonia is one of the main constituents when we do a chemical cleaning. We have not done a chemical cleaning since 1994, so there has been no ammonia waste that's been put into the pond since 94. So, again, this ammonia is a really hard constituent for laboratories to analyze for at these low levels. But, again, we have not had the ammonia in the surface impoundment since 1994.
Okay, I hear what you're saying, but what proof do you have that you don't have any of those constituents in those tests? And when we have a graph in front of us that was submitted by Mr. Schimmick that shows that there was a spike, what do you have to show that there wasn't one? And
this was the again, this is Lee Gans. This was in January of 2009. And then if you look in the second quarter when we did the analysis in April, these spikes were not there. And again, it was because the laboratory did not have the interference in their field blanks.
Again, Mr. Chair, to our staff, has the staff verified these analyses, and now are they satisfied?
Mr. Briggs, could you have staff respond to that?
This is David Schwartz, Fair Water Board staff. No, I have not verified that specific spike. That specific spike was due to lab error.
But nobody.
The direct answer is no.
Okay.
I would point out that the nitrogen concentration in that graph is low compared to a water standard, a drinking water standard of 10. And the nitrate, that's for nitrogen, and the nitrate standard has a drinking water standard of 45. But to directly answer your question, no, I have not verified that ammonia spike is due to lab error.
I have a question for staff. This is Tom O'Malley.
Go ahead.
And again, does the logic presented by the geologist make sense to you? Does that fit the...
Tom, can you speak up, please?
Yes, I'm...
That's better.
You can hear me better now?
Yes.
And again, for staff, having heard the presentation by the hydrogeologist, does that presentation make sense to you that this represents an isolated indicator, and if there were a leak, you'd expect multiple indicators? Could you comment a little bit on that presentation, and does that make sense to you?
This is David Schwartz. Our Dynegy presentation does make sense to me. I'm well aware that this is a dynamic situation hydrogeologically. I'm aware of seawater intrusion in the area. I am aware of tidal influences. I'm aware of the nearby surface water. So the explanations that Dynegy has provided do make sense to me. And I might add the DGSE staff review these data very carefully. And because of that, I do not review them as carefully as I would if DGSE staff were not there, a whole resource allocation issue. But the direct answer is yes, Dynegy's explanation makes sense. Thank you.
Any other board comments or questions?
Yeah, Gary Shawcross here. Could someone on our staff go through each of these four graphs that were submitted by Monterey Coast Keepers and tell us what the standards are for safe water on each of these? In other words, someone just mentioned that the ammonia spikes are well below water safety standards. Could someone comment on the other three graphs on what the standards are?
This is David Schwartz, our Water Board. I am speaking off the top of my head. I don't have all the standards in front of me. We're talking about four parameters here, pH, magnesium, sulfate, and ammonia as nitrogen.
Yeah, we heard about the ammonia and nitrogen. How about the other three?
You asked about safe water standards. Remember, there are two things to consider here. One is the safe water standards. Another is the standard that triggers a statistically significant increase. So there are two things that we're talking about. But as far as safe water standards, 8.5 pH units is still considered drinking water. I have forgotten the pH range that are the drinking water standards, but I believe 8.5 is well within the acceptable range. The magnesium drinking water standard, and of course we're talking about safe water and which beneficial use are you referring to? I'm referring by default to drinking water standards.
That's fine.
The magnesium standard, I don't recall offhand if there even is a magnesium standard. I'm almost positive there is not a primary drinking water standard. The primary standards are health-based. Secondary standards are nuisance-based, taste and odor primarily. I'm positive there is not a standard for magnesium as a primary standard. I do not think there is a secondary standard either, but I don't recall that right offhand.
Okay.
This is Roger Briggs. Magnesium is a component of hardness, which is also an aesthetic standard.
Thank you. The sulfate standard is also a secondary standard, drinking water standard, and
250.
I believe that the sulfate standard as a secondary drinking water standard, in other words, it's an odor nuisance, is 250 milligram per liter, and that is shown as the upper value on your graph, figure 2E.
Right. Thank you for that information.
And this is Jeff Young. What is the standard for ammonia?
Well, the drinking water standard for nitrogen is 10 parts per million. And the drinking water standard for nitrate, NO3, is 45 parts per million. And so here we're talking about a spike of about 2.2 shown on figure 2A compared to the 10 standard for nitrogen.
We ask a follow-up question to staff. If you took all of these graphs as, are any of these graphs actionable as far as enforcement goes?
Well, that gets back to whether they signify a statistically significant increase. The whole groundwater monitoring program is designed around increases. If there's an increase, theoretically, that indicates there might be a problem. And then there are retests required. And if those retests show the same data, then there are actions that are required if the other data also indicate releases. So whether these numbers we're seeing on these graphs are actionable, in other words, triggering a retest or not, I don't know right offhand.
Well, how would we ever know if they're actionable?
How would we know? I'm sorry, what was the question?
How would we know if we don't know now whether they're actionable? Will we ever know?
Oh, I would look it up. I don't have the numbers right in front of me.
Oh, okay.
If I had to determine that, I would look at their groundwater monitoring program.
I see. So you do have the information.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, when I say I don't know with regard to these data, that means I don't know offhand. I don't have files in front of me. I'm not referring to any papers.
Mr. Chair, I do have another question. This is Russ Jeffries in Lost Landing.
Go ahead, Mr. Jeffries.
And it goes back to notification. I know our board attorney addressed that everything was proper and legal. My question is that Dynalgy posted a notice in the Salinas Californian that the hearing would be held on September 11th. The first question is, was there a revision to that to make the notice as of August 31st? And the second part of the question is back to the staff that Mr. Schimmig pointed out that you could supply information to this particular hearing up to noon today. Was that corrected, or is that a correct statement that it was up till noon today?
This is David Schwartzport. As far as I know, there was no follow-up newspaper publication. So the June 17 notice in the newspaper of the September 11 meeting was the only one published in the newspaper that I know of. And as far as I know, it is still true that public comments, as we advertise them, are due by noon today.
And this is Francis, and that's a correct statement, and I would I believe that Mr. Schimmick did get his, obviously got his comments in by Thursday. And, if there are comments that come in before noon today and you've taken action, then I would recommend maybe bringing it back at some later date. But I think that there's been the first notice on June 17th required comments to be submitted by July 31st. So there was an adequate 45-day public comment period. There was additional 30 days provided that wasn't really necessary to be provided, but the notice that the date had changed was adequately noticed. So in my view, the notice has been adequate.
Someone said, if we take action before noon and someone sends in the comment after noon, you're suggesting that we reopen?
Well, we would see what the comments are and have they been addressed, and we'll see. I mean, I there, since there's already been 2.5 months of public comment, and the only public comment is Mr. Schimmick, you know, there's already been notice, and the second notice was kind of a bonus. So if there are more comments come in, then we'll have to see if it's appropriate to do anything else. But at this point, my view is that there's been adequate notice and there's been opportunity for comment that's been adequate.
Thank you.
And may I suggest, this is Jeff Young, may I suggest on that point that if we do take action to approve staff's recommendation, that if additional comments do come in, that the board itself be given those comments in a status report so we could take a look at those directly and not have staff, you know, filter that for us and make the determination that nothing further needed to be done.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is Russ Jeffries again. The reason I brought that point up is because historically on sensitive items, we have had communications from people at the 11th hour and the 59th minute of the proceedings on as far as submitting information, and I have concern it's almost 10 a.m. and there's 2 hours for people to do that to continue to approve this type of this item with that type of notification.
Mr. Jeffries, how would you feel if staff inform the board if it receives any additional comments, and then, you know, the board has the power to reopen this item if we go ahead and approve it today.
Well, I would, if we're going to approve it, then I would put the caveat that it would be approved on the assumption that we wouldn't receive any more comments. And if we did receive more comments, then they should be issued to the board members immediately for their response and action.
Okay. And then the board can decide whether the item should be reopened.
That's correct. And if we don't receive any, then, and if it is approved, then so be it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This is Roger Briggs. I just want to remind you that the original notice called for comments to be submitted by July 31st, and we did not receive any comments. And as our attorney pointed out, that met the legal standard. What we did was provide additional opportunity for comment when we notified people that we weren't changing the comment period, but we're just moving the meeting data. So we provided the legal notice, and we did not receive any comments by the deadline.
Well, I understand that, but and Francis has already clarified that, but the issue is that on my understanding on the website there was an opportunity for people to submit comments until noon today. And we have not reached that particular hour at this particular time. And I have concerns that they might have some more additional comments come in. And it's my job representing the public to hear all information on all items at the appropriate time.
And this is Francis. It's reasonable to, if you know, if there are more comments that come in, that come back to the board with a decision whether to reopen it again.
I don't have any problems with that.
Yeah, this is Gary Shawcross. I tend to support Mr. Jeffries' analysis of this. I think if we had just left it at the legal minimum, we would have been fine. But since we did open it publicly to an extended period, then I think we're stuck with that. I don't think we can arbitrarily close it before that.
This is Roger Briggs again. I wasn't suggesting arbitrarily closing it. I
hear you, Roger.
The reality of it. And I think the suggestions that a couple of board members have made as far as distributing the comments to the board, and as our attorney said, we can bring it back if that's appropriate, I think that's fine. I was just trying to point out that we didn't hear from anybody from the original legal notice, that's all.
Right.
And if I may add, this is David Schwartzbart. I've been through this renewal maybe 3 or 4 times in my years with the board, and I'd like to point out that the public is generally not very interested.
Whether they're interested or not, I think we have to hold our state we're leaving it open to.
Okay. Yeah, this is Dave Hodgett. I would certainly agree with that. I think we've said that we have the ability to reopen this item if necessary, if something comes in before noon. So I think we could proceed.
Yeah, on one hand, we have a legal standard. We've complied with it. I don't have a problem with that. There apparently is some confusion as to this additional 2 hours, whether that amount to more comments coming in. I would rather just make it known that we can take action, and if additional comments come in, that they be presented to the board with staff's recommendation on whether this item should be reopened or not. And, just do this in such a way that the public is not shortchanged somehow. But this just has to do with the noticing issue. You know, the other thing is whether there's been a release or not that's causing these groundwater spikes, and that is something that staff is saying has not been proven.
Well,
so we've got the two issues here.
Okay, Mr. Chair, this is Russ Jeffries in Lawrence Landing. Then, you know, that brings to mind, and that's kind of troubling me, and I know we met the legal notice. I understand that, and I agree. But I think, as Mr. Shellcross and I have both pointed out, that we have noticed it, the comments up till noon today. The other issue is that I'm concerned with the graphs and the spikes. And my preference to this is that we hold this whole issue over to the next meeting to meet the requirements that the staff has put up on the notification as far as noon today, and also the staff be able to reanalyze the graphs and give us any additional information that's necessary. And I think that would satisfy me and my thinking of where I'm going with this.
This is Frances. I just wanted to say something about that. One thing is that the permit expires the day before the next board meeting, so if you were to do that, I would recommend that you at least renew the permit or adopt an extension that at least lasts past, you know, for some period of time to allow for bringing the board.
I'm willing to do that, and I thought about that, you know, we could authorize Mr. Briggs to extend.
Well, no, you have to extend it. Mr. Briggs can't extend it.
Well, I mean, but the board would have to vote to extend that past that period of time. I understand that.
Okay, and then the other thing I wanted to say is that the legal standard here for these impoundments is to allow for the exemption is that there's no hazardous waste constituents have migrated from the surface impoundments. And just to remind you that both the staff and the discharger have testified that there's three liners at this facility or these facilities, and there's no leak that's been detected past the first liner. So there's two more liners. There's no leak that has been detected. So I just want to point that out, that the evidence actually presented at today's hearing, combined with lots of other things that have been presented, is that that no hazardous waste constituents have migrated from the facility. So I understand your concerns about the hydrogeologic data, which has been, responses have been given. But in addition, there's the standard is have hazardous waste constituents been migrate from the facility, and the evidence presented is that there has been no evidence of any leaks outside of the first layer of a three-liner system.
Mr. Chairman, this is Tom O'Malley.
Yes.
In my understanding, we have had all of the public testimony at this point and under discussion. I am satisfied that all criteria for renewal has been met, and I appreciate the most recent comments about no leaks past the first liner. I am concerned about the confusion of this particular meeting format. But I think if we moved ahead and any new information that's presented, of course, we could revisit this. And with that, just for the sake of discussion, I move we adopt staff's recommendation with the understanding that if additional information is presented in the next couple of hours, it's passed on to the board, and the board could have an opportunity to reconsider. But I think we should move ahead with staff's recommendation.
I agree and second the motion. This is Dave Hodgen.
Okay. Any board discussion on the motion that's pending? Any further discussion? Okay. All right. Why don't we have a vote on this motion? And
this is Russ Jeffries in Lost Landing. Can we have the motion repeated, please?
Yeah. And what I'd like to add about that is that in the staff report, the recommendation looks like it has only one component of really what the motion should be. And my understanding is from one of the slides that we've been asked to make specific findings to renew the exemptions.
This is Frances. I think you're fine that the waste discharge requirements include all the findings that are required to be made. So if you vote to approve the waste discharge requirements, you'll have be approving those findings.
Okay.
The one issue raised by the comments is the one I just discussed, the one about whether hazardous waste constituents have migrated from the unit. There has been no comment or question about any of the other findings.
Okay. All right, then let's have have the motion reread by staff so that we're clear as to what we're voting on.
Chair, before you do that, I would like to know if this motion passes that the staff notify all board members shortly after noon today if they received any additional comments.
We can do that. This is Roger.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And Mr. O'Malley, that's a friendly amendment to your motion?
Yes, and my understanding is we've heard the presentation today and find nothing that prevent us going forward with this motion. If new information comes up, then that would be something to reconsider.
Correct. And that if anything is presented to staff before noon, regardless of what it is, that the board shall be notified of what that is.
That was my question.
Yeah. If anything comes in, one way or the other, the board wants to know about it.
The board would be notified, and if it proves to be new information that a majority of the board have concern about, they could. Tim could always raise that as a future issue.
Right, and that'll be a determination by the board.
Yes.
Okay. Let's, Ms. Hewitt, could you call for a vote on this motion, please?
Jeffrey Young?
Yes.
John Hayashi?
Yes.
Monica Hunter?
No.
Tom O'Malley?
Yes.
Russell Jeffrey?
Yes.
Gary Shallcross?
I didn't hear Mr. Shallcross.
Yes.
Yes, okay. Okay, the...
David Hodgen.
Yes.
Okay, it looks like the motion passes 6-1. Thank you very much. This item is closed, and then I expect staff will let us know just after noon whether any additional information comes in. Okay, thank you for the presentations.
Thank you.